Hey, and welcome to the Strategy Sessions. My name is Andy Jarvis. I am the host of your show and the Strategy Director at Eximor Marketing. Thank you for coming along to listen today. My guest is Stephen Sabo, who runs Ethereal, a consultancy. What do Ethereal do? Well, let's hear from Stephen himself. They're into Web3.
It started as hype and it's dying down quickly. And I'm so happy it's dying down on that side because now we can get back to building.
He also runs Hampton's Tech Week.
It's like, you know, when you're in the Hamptons, everybody that you're rubbing shoulders with is a leader of industry. And you want to feel like, you know, that crowd networking, when it's a 1,000+ person event, you don't feel like it's curated to the level of every person you're going to run into is a great person to speak to.
Probably most importantly, he's a massive golf fan.
I landed at 7 in Dublin. I teed off at 8 at Royal Dublin.
But he does pair that with his work in the Web3 space. And finally, he has what seems like the greatest idea in history, a thing called Vin and Finn.
You know, and then it made it more free-flowing. And to be honest, like a lot of the times people are drunk by the end of it and they're asking really good questions.
Hopefully that's whetted your appetite. So let's just listen to the whole interview with Stephen Sabo, which we recorded a couple of weeks ago. And here, it's just in time for Hampton's Tech Week. If you're near the Hamptons, if you fancy a trip to the Hamptons and you want to put it down as a business expense, now is the time to do it. All the details are in the show notes. Let's get in and listen to Stephen Sabo. Thank you. Right then. So my guest today is Stephen Sabo, who is joining us from the United States of America. Stephen is the founder of Ethereal and the co-founder of Hampton's Tech Week. Thanks for coming on the show. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me, Andy. I appreciate being on and doing well.
No problem. Well, look, we met recently in Belfast, which we'll talk about in a moment. But I want to start by really diving into Hampton's Tech Week. It's one of those things that I think, you know, people all over the world have heard of Hampton's Tech Week, maybe looked and thought,
I hope so.
It's an event I want to go to. So tell us, you know, you're a co-founder there. How did the idea come together and what's the event like these days?
Sure. It really came together as us attending other conferences, right? And it kind of came out of, you know, we really wanted more education in, it started in the Web3 and blockchain space. We were going to a lot of conferences around the country, a few in London actually, and most of them turned into very big thousands of people pitches. A lot of the speakers would go on the stage and talk about their own product or business, less about the educational side, and then kind of exit stage left, get in the car, go home. And the value that I saw was seeing other people at the conference that I kind of already knew or by chance. And then I was, you know, we usually spend that time out east in the summer. And I was looking for conferences or ways to meet people out there, and there was nothing available. So we figured might as well do it ourselves. My other co-founder is Christine. She is an owner of James Lane Post, which is a media publication out in the Hamptons. And obviously my business, the Ethereal, you know, blockchain and Web3 consulting, I had some network in the space. I wanted to put people on stage and really educate the crowd in New York and out east about Web3 and blockchain. So that's kind of how it started. We jumped in and, you know, Southampton Arts Center was nice enough to host us in the first year last year. Got raving reviews. People really love the content, but mainly the value we were told was the people, just incredible people that came around and got on stage or attended, and that networking after and the, you know, the cohesiveness of the group seems to be the biggest value of what we were told so far.
Yeah. And I think there's some of the conferences I go to, and I do go to a lot, the ones that can wrap around that social element, that chance to meet people and right. Just have a spark with them, you know, not book a meeting, that's important, but just meet right. People in the bar afterwards or going for a walk. Yeah. There's a conference I've just come back from in Brighton, which is kind of 45 minutes to an hour down the coast from London.
Yeah.
And it has that same sort of thing. Everyone just spills out of the conference venue afterwards and you meet people in bars and restaurants afterwards. And it just kind of, what happens there is equally as important as what happens in the conference. So you've hit the golden formula by the sounds of it.
Yeah, we're hoping so. This year is going to be incredible. It'll be, you know, at the end of June. So we kind of always joke last year is on the other side of July 4th, but you know, at the very worst, even if the conference is horrible, you're still in the Hamptons for July 4th. So there's a great group. You know, this year the talent is even, you know, the people were referring other talent in, which just has become its own method to putting people on stage and really getting that talent to stay at the level that we want and increasing it. You know, it's really the group that we have this year is has expanded. You know, leaders in the industry was always our focus. We want to hear where the industry is going, where technology is being used from the top innovators and people in the C-suite, you know, companies you would recognize. That has stayed true to this year. And we've also added a ton of founders who are at the cutting edge in companies, but using new technologies. AI is going to be a big part of the conversation this year. Web3 and blockchain is still in the forefront. But anything else that people are using these days that's fairly new for the markets is interesting for us to hear about and learn about. So there's naturally going to be a lot of VC and family office, you know, hedge fund kind of people out there either looking to educate themselves on new businesses or also invest in companies that are on stage or are attending. So yeah, it's going to be a good time this year. Like I said, it's June 27th to the 29th.
And I think the thing you mentioned about keeping it slightly smaller in scale mm-hmm. compared to some of the major conferences, I know having, and this isn't a criticism necessarily, I've been to the Web Summit, which is the major European tech conference. It grew in Dublin right. from small to huge, and then went to Lisbon, where it's even bigger now.
Yeah,
it felt a little bit like being at a cattle ranch, was my experience of being there. You know, there was just so many people and so many things and so many stages. You know, you could go and just get lost almost. So I think I prefer those more personal, slightly smaller scale events.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, the boutique feel, like I said, seems to be the most important. I mean, it feels like, you know, when you're in the Hamptons, everybody that you're rubbing shoulders with is a leader of industry. And you want to feel like, you know, that crowd networking, when it's 1,000+ person event, you don't feel like it's curated to the level of every person you're going to run into is a great person to speak to, right? It might not be great for your business, or you don't know what their motivations are of being there. You know, in a small boutique event, there's a lot more checks and balances that kind of go into it that make it such a successful curated experience that we really find people, you know, want to attend every year. And we plan to expand outside of the Hamptons too, but in a very thoughtful way and still a small way, maybe attached to other events that are going on. But yeah, that's always going to be an effective way to do things if you're not trying to waste time and kind of really do volume plays by meeting people and giving out cards, if people still even do that. But yeah, it's definitely a fun way to do it. At least that's what I think.
So you think, here, you've touched on something that's really close to my heart. I still have business cards and I still give them out. And one of the reasons I do it is because nobody else does anymore. You know, so it's like, oh, just connect on LinkedIn and, you know, do this.
Is your marketing guy.
Yeah, that's it, right? You know, when everyone zigs, zag. So I love handing out business cards so that that someone's got something physical, because then hopefully at least that sticks in their mind a little bit. So I'm a big fan of business cards and some of the old school ways.
Yeah. It's funny. It's made its way back if you use it in the right way. If you're still doing the old paper cards and that's your only method of contact, obviously it's a different approach. But it is funny, the way to stand out is always going to change, right? Like it's funny. I had a discussion about this a few days ago. Physical mail has even come back in the sense of, if you have something addressed with your name on it, when's the last time besides to build your house that you've had a piece of physical mail delivered, even in your office, even though if it goes to your office, you may never get it, cause you know, you never get into the office or like once a week. But especially your home, I mean, I'm open everything up that's delivered, you know, personally to me, cause I'm curious about it. Emails are, God, I can't even get through my email, in a day, regardless, even how important it is, let alone marketing. So you've got the marketing brain for sure.
Well, this is it. I cut my teeth 20 some years ago, as doing direct mail. That's how I started in marketing, was doing direct mail. And the skills you learn with that, you know, people say, oh, how do you do email marketing? And we're like, well, much like we used to do direct mail. And how do you craft a message like you used to do in direct mail? And Yeah, a lot, there's a lot of lessons I learned from that, which I still use every single day, even though we rarely do mail now, but it's still a great thing.
Yeah, for sure.
So jumping forward from direct mail, which is a very old tool, to your other job, your full-time job in terms of your consultancy and Web3 blockchain. So tell us a little bit about the consultancy, first of all, and then I'll kind of throw in the contrary questions about, is there a future for all of this sort of thing?
Yeah, of course. I mean, Ethereal really started from a standpoint of, you know, people needed advice in the space, but also needed the education on the front end because a lot of people didn't even know what Web3 was. And it started there as what the tools even are in this space of using blockchain and using Web3 for your business in terms of marketing or direct to customer or, you know, royalties in the future for an artist. There's all these features that you can push and pull, but it became a buzzword very quick. So it kind of polarized the marketplace, right? And people jump past the functionality. So actually for a second, I'll take a minute to educate on the Web3 side for anybody who doesn't recognize it. It really started as just iterations of the internet. It was read only as Web1, read and write as Web2, and then Web3 became read, write, and execute, which essentially just means you can effectively have digital ownership of a physical or digital asset, right? So that became very important because it's a confirmed contract, right? A smart contract goes on the blockchain and it's immutable. You can't forge that, fake that. It's a contract and a transaction that goes directly on the ledger that's confirmed, right? So it makes security much easier, but it also makes proving things that you own and you know, personalization of, you know, your interaction with a business much more direct. So just that in mind, and digital ownership is like, all right, well, whatever my business is, how can I use these features, right? And that's kind of where I stepped in as Ethereal. It's like, all right, I see paths for your business. This isn't even important. You don't need to make this blockchain. This is a feature that you might be able to want to use. This is reason X, Y, and Z. So, you know, we got into a bunch of different projects. My passion is sports entertainment. We've gotten into a few. I've talked to you offline about this, but golf has become, I mean, it was always a passion of mine. Now it's become a business passion as well. We can get into that a little bit later, but that was a pure functionality of, you know, bringing blockchain and Web3 into the golf space, just under a membership model, nothing else, just using contracts at a country club or, you know, any membership club as a smart contract. And that gave you so many other options after. I'll get into that a little bit more later, but that's a quick background on Ethereal.
And I think you were right in terms of going down the consultancy angle. I mean, maybe it's interesting why you went down the consultancy and not sort of product building angle. Mm-hmm. But it, whenever any new technology explodes onto the market, there is a kind of a hype cycle comes with it. A lot of people jump into it. That usually causes a boom and bust cycle at some point. Mm-hmm. And some people get burned, and then there's a whole bunch of people declare the death of whatever the technology is. And then we repeat again and again and again.
Yep.
Now, absolutely. We are probably in the space where people are declaring the death of Web3, crypto, blockchain, et cetera, et cetera. But you're seeing a very different angle to that. There are endless use cases for Web3 technologies, but there is also probably a boom and bust cycle, which is probably best to have bust, do you think?
Yeah, so you've hit on a great point, and it's something that I've been trying to, I don't even really say the word NFT anymore. There's no reason to put yourself into this polarized market to where people have like a very strong opinion on it. It's like having a strong opinion on contracts, right? Like, you can make a contract into anything. It's why would you have such a strong opinion on it if you don't understand it, right? So the business model for a lot of these projects in the past were based on FOMO. And the whole business model was like, all right, I don't want to miss out on it. I'm going to buy it in now. I don't really understand it fully, but it's going up, right? And that, to base your business model on that drove me insane. I mean, my background was finance and, you know, I'm attached to an investment bank now. And again, we could talk about that later, but I knew the fundamentals of a lot of these businesses were not there, and it was based on FOMO. So that's the bad branding and the side of Web3 and NFTs that it started as hype and it's dying down quickly. And I'm so happy it's dying down on that side, because now we can get back to building and using the functionality of the tools that don't need to be talked about, right? I use my iPhone, you use whatever phone you use, right? It's going to be an iOS system. That's not why I bought it. Apple didn't tell me all the great features of an iOS operating system, right? I bought it because I can use it. I can call people, text people, go on the internet, whatever it is. I don't need to know the background of it. So I just need to know why it's better or why the functionality will help me in business or in life and make things easier. So that's kind of where we are today. I'm very happy the death of Web3, like, thank God, because it's finally over from the hype cycle and we can get back to building.
And I think we've had Kelly Cambray on talking before about that, you know, Web3 and the futures and things like that. And I think my big question about where Web3 technology may be going is that, I can't tell you how much I hate the word disruption, but I'm going to have to use it here, is that it has the potential to disrupt the way that major businesses operate, things like banks, things like, like you say, anywhere where contracts exist, whether that's real estate or whatever. The history of those businesses suggests that they don't like and they don't let new incumbents come in and disrupt their business model. They've got skin in the game so much. You know, are they the ones driving the change, or do you think they're going to be the ones resisting the change and kind of trying to keep the seas back?
It's a tough question. I mean, I've worked in one of the most antiquated systems through the insurance industry. It is, and the healthcare industry in the States. It's so antiquated, and it's very, very frustrating. But I know it takes a very long time to move that giant of whatever the insurance company is in the industry into new technology, right? So I understand why they take so long, because it costs a lot of money and you better be really sure that it works. And it basically has to be a no-brainer by the time they actually move. A great example is the insurance industry right now, right? Healthcare, the HIPAA system in the States, I don't know your healthcare system, but our system is we're individuals that go to doctors, and there's, you know, HIPAA rules with the doctors. They hold your records. But if I'm trying to get life insurance for you, I have to go to those doctors to get your medical records. They take, it could be anywhere from 4 to 10 weeks to send the records, and you have to mail it in. They like fax it to you. I don't even know what fax is. It's, you know, it's, you got to wait for a fax from this doctor. They put it into your system. The whole process takes a very, very long time. There's no reason that it shouldn't just be somebody's account that I give access to. It could be on the blockchain and it could be instantaneous. But this system is now a 3-month process to get life insurance, at least, especially if you're over the underwriting limits, right? If you're going for, you know, higher end insurance. And we just know it could be fixed so much easier by using the blockchain and stuff like that. So that's, you know, an instant functionality that will be there eventually. We just saw California go into the driver's license system is now through the blockchain. It's just much more direct, quick, and easy. But it's going to take a lot of time for industries and states and, you know, legislation to catch up with that.
And I think you've hit on a point there. We talked when we met about the differences between the UK and the US, or Europe and the US. And I think one of the big differences between the States and Europe is the view of government. Most people, right. I say most, I'm generalizing hugely, but in the US, government has quite there's a dim view generally of the government trying to get involved in things. Over in Europe, you can see things like GDPR legislation. When you're talking about doctors faxing medical records to people, I've got a GDPR headache going on. And I'm like, God, how'd you get away with that? Right? Goes to the wrong fax machine, wrong person, set, all that sort of stuff. But Europe is using legislation to drive certain things forward. Now, whether the legislation's right or wrong, that's not the point. But if you look at the banking system over here, or the insurance system and things like that, it feels like we're light years ahead of the US. I had a payment coming from a US client not long ago. It took about 7 days, and I was chasing and chasing. And I was told, oh no, there's actually a manual process the bank has to go through to send it from the US. I'm like,
crazy.
Annual check?
Account, what is this?
$100. I mean, it wasn't even a big amount of money.
Right.
But I think that's been the joint of the legislation forcing innovation. And is that happening in the, is that drive going to happen, do you think, in the US?
Yes and no. I mean, I think it really starts, I guess legislation can be a part of it, but in the US, I think the companies really drive it, right? A great example is going to be Starbucks, right? There's always the leader in that industry that will take the first step. You know, they were the first ones to take the step for Wi-Fi. Everybody thought they were crazy to put free Wi-Fi into a local Starbucks, right? People are never going to leave. There's all these reasons that they shouldn't do it. And they became geniuses for it. And now everybody does it, right? It's one of those things that they're now taking a step into the Web3 space through Odyssey. And it's a great case study. It's one of my favorites. But nobody even knows it's really a blockchain Web3 project for the most part. It's just a loyalty program that they're using that's much more effective. And you can really have a much better customer journey in relationship with your company when you do it this way, right? So it takes steps like that for people, one, to understand it, two, to recognize that Starbucks is now the leader in the space and how they can do it. And then, hopefully my answer is that you engage a consultant, but either the options are to have somebody in-house who understands this, which the talent pool is fairly small for right now, or you hire in a consultant that can, one, understand your business, but then also understand the side that you're trying to, get into, right? So if it's blockchain and Web3, you got to have an expert there, but they also have to understand whatever your business is too. And that's going to take, right? New technology is every 7 years. It'll take about full 7 years to get there. And I would guess we're about three into it. So I still see a very long road to getting this stuff integrated into regular business, but it's getting there. People are building in the space quietly now. They're not doing it, on billboards anymore like it was about a year and a half, 2 years ago, but they're there. And trust me, I've been talking to them. People are building really cool things.
So it sounds like I have a keynote that I do for corporate clients called Everybody's in Marketing. So trying to get everyone in the team to think that.
Yep.
And when you talk, the way I talk about marketing is the way you mentioned it there with Starbucks and this new thing they're doing with Odyssey. Didn't know about it. But for me, it's about not the technology. It's about what benefit does it have for the customer?
Yes.
And once you put the customer at the heart of it, I mean, to me, marketing, the clue's in the name, right? Market.
Yep.
My discipline is about the market. And people forget that because they come obsessed with technology or tools or meta products or whatever. But as long as you put the customer at the heart of what you're doing, it reduces the chances that anything's going to go wrong. So I love the fact that that's now, that's what you're seeing in the sector.
Yeah. So there's you've actually touched on a really, really great part, right? Why would the customer do this, right? And what happened in the Web3 world that's going to benefit the customer with digital ownership, right? It's now there's a new monetization tool and a direct ownership that benefits the customer, right? So back in Web2, you had a thing which was called participatory second parties, which you would have a login, right? So it would be anybody you had social media on that would direct you with marketing to a company, right? So that was the way of centralizing things, because now I would find a lot of businesses that I engage with through Facebook, and they kept your data and they monetized the hell out of your data, as you can see, as big as Meta is now, mm-hmm. right? They did it really well. But now what happens, if you have that digital ownership, you can now monetize your own data and you can own your own journey, right? So that becomes a very, very powerful tool, because now instead of Starbucks, paying Meta to find me as a customer and then I have a journey, now they can offer me more in terms of loyalty and rewards because they found me directly and they've kept me as a customer this whole way. And also, through KYC and everything that you're going to be able to verify your customer. Now it's not like I have four emails on the Starbucks app. It's all over the place and I don't even remember which one I used. Now it's one customer through one account or wallet, if you want to call it that. A custodial wallet would be the way that they're actually using that customer journey through.
the opportunities are, when you talk about it in those terms, almost endless for consumer businesses, but also in the B2B space as well. You know, anywhere where you have relationships with people, there's opportunity. So,
think about the ways that you can break down and market to customers now, right? If they have their own custodial wallet, right, and we know that customer engaged exactly on all these transactions, right? This was their purchase habit. This was their, the size of their purchase and the frequency, right? There was really no way that was super effective to break down your customers and market only to those people, right? Now I can go, if I'm an artist, I can say, all right, my first 100 tickets or first 100 albums sold in 1998, right? I can pull back the exact wallets who those were if it was Web3. Right? An artist came out now, launched something, and in 20 years from now, you can say, hey, I'm doing a private concert for my first 100 people, and I know exactly who they were. Like, that was very, very hard to prove from an artist standpoint years ago. There's no way to really track it and prove it, right? If I bought the CD and I could just give it to you, and then there's no proof that I was the first owner of it, right? I was telling you this. There's also another factor of this becomes the clout factor of like the cool side of this from a social capital standpoint. Now I can prove all of the nonprofits that I support directly. If it's on my personal wallet, right? I can put that in a public wallet and show you how I engage with the brands that I like, the artists that I like. You know, if I was at the first ever Avicii concert in New York, that could be on my social profile if I allow it to be public. And it's proven, right? I'm not making it up. So the social capital side of this becomes really, really interesting. You know, you can, you know, there's guys obviously in the UK, I'm a big soccer fan, right? And you can prove if you're a plastic fan or not, right? Like there's a way to say, no, I've been following this team since the first day, right? There's track records of it. I have this ticket, and it just becomes such a cool way to engage with the brand and really, you know, make sure that people want to engage more because it's going on there and it's proven and it's, you know, from the golf side of things, I kind of created a model here that, you know, if I played a top 100 courses, there's no way like I could say that. But if I had a badge that was proven and it came on by geofencing, instantly, I know that guy, like he did play 50 of the top 100 courses. So it just kind of snowballs on this with all the fun ideas.
So what you've done is I started off as very negative on Web3 because of the hype cycle. You then sold it to me. And now you've made it sound like a hipster nightmare. So you know, like, oh no, I could prove I was into their earlier work. That's what
it's gonna
be a hipster nightmare. This is gonna be
we live in a hipster nightmare already, don't we? So what's the difference?
Geez. I think I'm done here. Let's keep
it's
talking
good
about
to prove, right? But now take the nonprofit side of it, right? Like he's been supporting XYZ nonprofit since the 80s, right? That's a better way to think of it instead of the hipster nightmare.
Look, we both know where this is going. This is going to be, I had a ticket to the first Adele gig and stuff like that. But that's
okay. Of course.
That's okay. So let's stick on golf for a minute then, because golf is...
Talk my language.
Global game, right? You're a huge fan. Now, I couldn't pick up a golf stick and use it properly if I tried, but maybe I'll learn as I get older, right? But golf isn't necessarily a sport that you would immediately go, golf... new technology. Now you'd be wrong. I'm a huge sports fan and I'm a sports tech bore. So I know there's huge technology in golf clubs, golf balls, course designs.
Right. The actual. Yeah.
But when you look at who plays golf,
right,
it tends to be you start about 40, the average age in the golf club or the country house is going to be over 70. And it's not necessarily an industry you go, this place is ripe for new technology. So talk to us about what you're doing there and the challenges you're facing.
So You're 100% right on the demographics, right? The clubs are a different thing, right? There's technology and there's talk about rolling them back, the technology at this point, because it got so good. The demographics are getting there slowly, right? So you're starting to see cool people play golf, right? Athletes, entertainers. It's now getting to that vibe to where it's opening the doors, but it's still a very stringent way that you play golf. It's very traditional. That hasn't been updated as much. That's kind of what I'm working on now. I think a lot of it is based on the technology and the way that we're using Zoom and people aren't going to into offices as much. I think there's going to be a whole wave to make golf shorter in terms of time commitment, because I don't have 5-6 hours to commit to a round of golf, driving there, playing full 18 holes, maybe having a bite to eat after. That's just such a big chunk of time. If you have a business, a family, you know, the weather is a big part of that, right? And it just doesn't make it as easy and as kind of an open door to come play it. So one, time's a factor. Two, the accessibility of golf just wasn't there, right? There's a few ways on the U side that I'm working. I'm working with the Paint Store Kids Foundation. The way that they're getting it out to youth is by using bigger clubs, hitting tennis balls into nets instead of a traditional golf ball and golf club, which is, but I can barely do it at this point. And I've been playing for, you know, 20 years, right? So it's just a hard game to learn. And I want to be able to put my son and daughter into golf the same way I'm able to put them into soccer and t-ball, right? It's the, when they're 3 years old, there's no, you know, infrastructure right now to put them in golf. So that's one side. I think that's very important. The other side of it is the intimidation factor of golf. It's very intimidating to go to a first tee at a country club or a course and have people watching you there. And if you don't play golf like that is a nightmare, right? I know that anxiety. And like I've said, I've been playing for 20 years. I still get that anxiety on the first tee because it's just not a comfortable situation when it's a 400-yard hole. You have 18 holes in front of you. So my solution here, one, is to shorten the courses. I like par three courses. I like the one to be quicker rounds, right? I want you to be able to play in an hour and a half. The hole can be, you know, 80 to 150 yards, right? And nobody's going to sit on that tee and be really intimidated. You can go out with more than four people. It doesn't have to be the traditional model. And just play your round, right? There's going to be breaks in between. It's going to be much more the scoring clubs side of thing. Like, you don't have to pound a driver to be able to score on a short course, but it makes you very good at the game from the short game. I mean, anybody who has ever heard anything about golf knows that putting is the most important thing. Short game is very important, right? So if you practice that, that's going to make you more comfortable to go on the bigger courses and really take up the game more later. So, you know, that's one side, the accessibility from a feel standpoint and age standpoint and demographics too. You know, the cities don't have that access. So when somebody like the Paint Store Foundation can, you know, put you in a public park or a gym and you can still be playing golf as a, you know, in the youth academies or whatever it's going to be, that's a very different feature. You're reaching a whole new demographic. And now the, you know, the leagues and the country club models was another step that I've taken into this, that I think the antiquated country club model isn't the way for a lot of people to join. It's very stringent in terms of when you join, there's a big initiation fee. Typically it's a very illiquid asset and it's more of a bill than an asset, right? It's, I don't care if you're there or not. You have to pay your bill every month to get privileges to be on that course and to use the facilities. And the membership process too is another barrier of entry. Public courses just don't really have free flowing golf, like the good ones or the ones near major metro are just packed all the time. So again, you're not having the experience that makes you want to come back because it's very, very busy. So again, I've created a model for this for the par three courses called Liquidity Country Club. It's a way that we use the blockchain for membership model. And now your membership token, quote unquote, is going to be fluid, right? So you buy it just as if you were joining a country club, but if you want to leave in a year or two, you're going to be able to transfer or lease your token to somebody else, right? So you're giving your membership to somebody else who wants to join. And now that makes it, you know, transferable. You can either sell it or lease it. And now I'm like, all right, I actually will join this course because it's not a sunken fixed cost of the initiation fee and the annual dues. Now I can at least have some lever to pull on that gets me out of that, or at least pauses that for a minute. Also the, you know, the transferable nature of this makes reciprocity easier. So now I can make a relationship with another course and I can prove that I'm a member right away because now it's on the blockchain, right? My contract is there. It makes it much more fluid, transparent, and fair, to be honest, right? There's entrances into tournaments where it's kind of like a sneaker drop. I don't know if you know that culture in the States, but you have to sit there like you're going on for a sneaker drop, put your name in a hat, like click the buttons and put your name and just see kind of where you end up on the list. Like if it's through the blockchain, you could just have a 2-minute period, you know, to where it's like, all right, submit your entry. It's a raffle. And then it gets sorted, you know, randomly, instead of saying, all right, this guy had the fastest Wi-Fi, or, you know, this guy, you know, got in for a certain other reason and maybe typed slow or made a mistake. That's a silly reason to not be able to, you know, play around at a different course, right? If there's only 10 rounds available and you want to go play somewhere else, it's either decided by like favorites or whenever you get there. So there's just more features that make it fair as you go. And it, you know, that could be put onto a lot of other industries, but you know, we're talking about golf right now. So that's kind of the way that I've been building out Liquidity Country Club.
So you also shared a stat, and I think they, let me start that again. I think there's a great rationale that you can see driving where you're going with this. You shared a stat the other day of daytime golf, according to some measurements, has gone through the roof in the States, up about 83, 85% since COVID. So yeah, working from home, we can.
So work days,
work day golf. So
that's a great point.
But if you can, you know, that shows there's demand there. And I think that, you know, for shorter golf, of being able to play in, like say, 90 minutes as opposed to 5 hours is a huge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that, you know, I think your job, it would be much more likely to have you go entertain a client or do a networking golf thing if it's going to be an hour and a half, but it's not your entire day, you know, taken out from work for it. Night golf is another feature that I didn't talk about with the par three courses. There's going to be the par three courses, pickleball, and a social club. We're going to have places to stay, to rent out, and eventually buy. But the night golf side of this, right, putting up lights and being able to play into the night, you know, and having a corporate outing that takes an hour and a half or 2 hours, that you could tee off at 7 o'clock under the lights. That's a much more dynamic, fun way than the traditional, like, 6-hour golf outing. You go in, you have your plate, you watch an auction, right? It could just be much more dynamic than what it used to be. Not saying that needs to change. I'm not trying to change the whole golf world from the old traditional model to this. I'm just saying there's room for improvement or addition. So that's kind of where we're at with that. We do have a project coming out in New York that I'm working on now that we could be announcing, but it's really exciting. It's within an hour and 20 minutes of the city. It's going to be a fun one. And I will be taking beginners just like you, Andy, to go out, learn the game, have a good experience. But there's other stuff to do in the area too. Like, you always want to attach golf with some other fun stuff too. It doesn't have to be such a narrow culture.
So lots of things that you've talked about from the golf side of things and before with some of the work, you know, like Starbucks, what they're trying, and all of this stuff sounds great and exciting, but also relatively expensive. It's going to need some capital behind it. Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier on you're attached with an investment bank. But what's the scene like at the minute in terms of opportunities for investment? Because there's obviously some macroeconomic issues in the global economy at the moment. Is that sort of filtering down into investment into, you know, kind of Web3 technologies?
I would say the answer there is just kind of based on a company's budgets or whatever people want to invest to, right? The companies or individuals that are investing are making choices based on kind of where the markets guide them, right? That's very different from what a company, more of what Ethereal does and consults on, is the company side of investment into themselves. So, you know, they're not investing in Web3 in my mind. They're just whatever you're going to use on a marketing budget or whatever you're going to do on a new process or change an old process. One, it's either going to be to save money or to make your marketing efforts more effective. Right. So I don't see it as a Web3 budget. I see it as your marketing budget. So that's kind of where, you know, I'm trying to shift the thinking of, like, it just becomes another one of those tools. You know, it doesn't have to be the whole thing. It doesn't have to be its own budget. It just becomes a part of the conversation.
Gotcha. No, makes absolute sense. And I think when you go back to what we were saying about putting the customer at the heart of it, then it does become just it's everyday spend as opposed to something separate.
Okay. Exactly. Yeah.
When we talk about your finance background as well, though, that you also started and chief executive officer of possibly my favorite thing I've ever seen, Vin and Finn. let's talk about that, Vin and Finn.
So, I would love to. So Vin and Finn was a trademark, of course, that I came up with. My finance company is Simple Society. So Simple Society was based on educating individuals and companies, you know, the employees of companies, through a new system. And that system I used was an educational structure called Vin and Finn. It was a 90-minute course. I would have four flights of wine. And in between each flight of wine, there would be an educational piece about finance or insurance. But that finance or insurance could be anything. It was just an educational structure. But what I did for Vin and Finn, I would hire a sommelier and I would hire a CFP, a certified financial professional. And we would go around the country. We would teach employees. We would go to the VIP events, would be at great restaurants. Or we would go right into the conference room and bring in the glasses and the wine and teach the employees what they need to know. But do you remember, I don't know if you've ever been to a financial seminar in the States, but they are brutal. Like it is not a fun way to learn. Most people are not dynamic communicators, you know, on the stuff that's already boring, finance and insurance. So this broke it down into more palatable bites. The way that you would teach about a topic would be about 6 to 8 minutes. The wine education is 12 to 15 minutes, but 6 to 8 minutes on a financial topic. And you can think about it much easier. And when you have those breaks and it's a little bit more of a fun environment instead of just getting pounded by information and data and advice, you know, it wasn't personal advice, but we would teach about things like at a tech company, we would teach about your stock options or, you know, just the basics of retirement plans in the States, what the differences are, you know, and then it made it more free flowing. And to be honest, like a lot of the times people are drunk by the end of it and they're asking really good questions. So it became such a fun event. We did a ton of them back in 2019 and then the world shut down. I opened up Ethereal and really never looked back. I haven't done a Vin and Finn since then.
I feel like you're missing a trick. You should get back to
Vin. I want to get back to it, but again, I can see it being other educational tools, right? Whatever that finance and insurance could be, you know, teaching other things. It could be Web3, it could be marketing, it could be whatever we want. But yeah, I agree with you. We should get back.
I think, well, you heard it here first. Vin and Finn, the marketing option, is coming to Ireland very shortly. We'll get that lined up and open, and I'll talk about it as soon as we get it on. I think the bit about, so when I, the best bit of feedback I ever got from a presentation I gave was effective, educational, entertaining. And then there was a little bit of extra that they put on it. You know, like effective, I felt like I could do my job better. Educational, I learned something. Mm-hmm. Entertaining, I didn't feel like I was being taught. And
right.
I find if you can entertain people, they will, the message will stick, as opposed to just telling them, like you say, the boring, hello, my name's Nigel from finance. No one cares, right? They've switched off already.
Of course, yes.
So, you know, God. Again, I love the concept.
Yeah, no, I would love to bring it to Ireland. And that is how we met, you know, a bunch of events out in Ireland. And man, the crack, as they call it,
the crack,
real.
Yeah, the crack. So we've come full circle. We're back to events. So we met at the Digital DNA Awards in Belfast, which is possibly the biggest tech awards in Ireland now. Definitely the biggest in Northern Ireland. There was 700, 750 people in a room. It was incredible. And even with 750 people in the room, you had the misfortune of being sat next to me. So tell me why I was the greatest person to sit next to in the whole night.
I don't have enough time. First, I just want to thank Simon from Digital DNA. Simon was incredible my entire trip. I mean, that's what I based the trip around, coming out to the Digital DNA Awards and really paving the relationship between Digital DNA and Northern Ireland and Ireland with Hampton's Tech Week, right? I always heard that people wanted to get over to the States. There's business reasons, there's personal reasons, but we just thought there was a lot of synergy. So I wanted to see, you know, how we ran the awards. And I mean, to be honest, there's no way we can do an award show that big over the next couple of years. Like, he really put on a show. It was incredible people, but he also went above and beyond and he set up personal meetings for me when I was there. And I felt, you know, like a belt ball, right? It was every meeting all day. I was having coffee and lunches and drinks. The Guinness is incredible over there. But he really laid out the red carpet. There was a bunch of people. I mean, that's really what made the event even more incredible. And the experience was everybody I met was on point and really just a great person. and willing to get into it on the business side and support. It really felt like a community, and man, Simon has curated that really well.
Yeah, and look, Belfast has come a long way in a very short space of time, and it manages to keep that great combination of friendly welcoming while focusing on trying to do business. Yeah. You know, there's a story that came out. We had President Biden in Ireland recently.
Yeah.
And Joe Kennedy III is kind of the business envoy now. And he was telling a story from, there was a major US insurance company. The CEO flew into Ireland to do basically the deal to open up the very first office. And he arrived in Ireland, his suitcase didn't. So he had a meeting the next day and he was basically in sports casual. So he went to the nearest suit shop to his hotel in Ireland, tried a suit on. The guy was like, brilliant. He said, look, we've got the jacket. He said, but the pants didn't fit. They were way too long and too big in the waist. 5:15 at night. So the shop was closing. And the CEO was like, listen, I've got a meeting tomorrow morning. My bag hasn't arrived. And the guy who owned the shop was like, there's nowhere open. I'll drive it back to my mother's. She'll make the changes for you. Which hotel are you in? I'll drop it back. 7:15 the next morning, knock at his hotel door, handed him the pants that had been altered by his mother so he could wear them and turn up in full suit for a meeting. And the CEO told this to Joe Kennedy III. He was like, you just don't get that anywhere. And he said, like, no politician could sell me Ireland in a way that guy did that morning.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of, but that's...
That is quintessential what I felt about it. 100%. That was the entire feel of the trip the whole time. They were entertaining. They were welcoming. They put your arms around you and wanted to everybody to succeed. They all felt like they were friends. And, you know, it was just such a culture that you get some of that over in the States, but the whole area doesn't feel like that, right? It feels more of like a group of friends thing or a company or some collection of people for a reason. That's when it feels like that, not the whole of Belfast, right? That's it was very, very refreshing to see. It was my first time in Belfast. So, you know, I'll definitely be back. There were so many good people that I'll meet and I'll also bring over to Hamptons Tech Week.
Excellent. No, and look, it is. It's a real. I love the city. I really do. And don't get me wrong. I love Dublin. I love all of Ireland. I'm not a native, as you pick up from the accent. But yeah, you're right. There's a definite energy to the city, and I think it came out of quite a long period of terrible times, obviously.
Yep.
And there's just a whole energy of the majority of people want to make things better, which is a really great place to start from.
They really do.
When you were over, I have to ask you: did you get any golf in when you were over in Ireland?
I did. That's funny.
Now, hold on. You didn't tell your wife you were playing golf, did you? This is what's happened here. I put you on the spot.
No, she knows I can't avoid golf. It's in me. It's within me. So I literally left my son's soccer practice 5 o'clock. The Monday I was flying, I was taking the red eye. Got to the airport, flight was at 7. I landed at 7 in Dublin. I teed off at 8 at Royal Dublin. So that kind of gives you, you know, what my level of obsession for golf is. But I did have, it was still a positive experience, but a little bit of a heartbreak at Royal County Down. So on my drive up from Dublin into Belfast, I was like, of course I'm going here. And the pro was very welcoming. You know, the assistant was there. I was going to be able to play. There was torrential downpours, which is usually you can play right through the rain in Ireland. Just have your suit on. You can do whatever you want. But they're redoing about half of their course. So a lot of their fairways, a lot of the tee boxes were dirt or mud at this point. And there was almost like mudslides and they pulled everybody off the course. So I didn't get to play arguably the best course in the world. They told me, rain check for whenever you're back. And I go, well, I'm not here too often, but I will make sure that I get back here. But man, even being on the grounds was like a religious experience for me. It was just such an incredible place. I mean, Irish feels like that. Irish golf feels like that to me in general. It's just the true way that golf started, you know, using the land and very creative. But yeah, I will be back to use that rain check for sure at Royal County Down someday.
Brilliant. No, it's a stunning course. I've kind of been around the outsides of it. I've never been on the course, but the whole area where it is down in Newcastle is
it's beautiful.
Amazing. So
yeah, it's so nice.
If you've never been, you've got to go down to that part of the country.
Yes.
Well, listen, look, I know you have a flight to catch this evening, so if anybody needs to contact you or wants to contact you, where's the best place? Are you LinkedIn, are you Twitter, or you know, what's the best place for you?
So LinkedIn is great. I use Instagram a lot. So obviously my LinkedIn for all the businesses, I post a lot on Imperial and share a lot of thoughts on my personal Hamptons Tech Week, same thing. You'll get a lot of more information. We're going to be doing a press release first half of May, releasing tickets and telling you, you know, who the speakers are going to be, what the panel conversation is going to be like. Personally on the golf side, I use my personal Instagram a lot. So that's a very good way for DM and my email, obviously through Ethereal. But I appreciate it.
Cool. We'll put a link to your LinkedIn in the show notes, which are just whatever platform you're looking on. They're in there. You'll be able to find Stephen from there. And look, reach out to him if you've got something in the space that you're thinking of, and find him on a golf course somewhere near you sometime soon. So Stephen Sable, thank you very much for your time.
Andy, thank you so much, man. I appreciate this. This has been so much fun, and I enjoy seeing you again soon. I'll look forward to either having you at Hamptons Tech Week or running a Vin and Fin with you over in Ireland.
Let's get that started.
Let's do it.
Thank you.
Thanks, bro.